hole they all cut across.
Oh, da doo da day. Gonna run all night. Gonna run all day. Bet my money on a bobtail nag. Somebody bet on the bay.
I went down south with my hat caved in.
Doo da, doo da.
I came back north with a pocket full of tin.
Welcome to Library on the Go. We bring stories and adventures to you. I'm Ms. Laura.
And I'm Ms. Barbara.
From the Cortez Public Library. And today Ms. Barbara has two stories for you.
This first one is kind of special to me because it's written by Marguerite Henry. And she was a very favorite author of mine when I was growing up. She wrote about horses, and I have loved horses all my life. And this is about a big Belgium workhorse. And he's called 5 o'clock Charlie by Marguerite Henry, illustrated by Wesley Dennis, published by Rand McNally and Company. Charlie was a big old workhorse with sad brown eyes and shaggy feathers on his feet. He belonged to Mr. Spinks, a lean, weathered man with a fringe of yellow whiskers that almost matched Charlie's mane. They both lived at Tulip Hill Farm in Shropshire, England. Mr. Spinks and everyone else thought Charlie was too old to work. Everyone, that is, except Charlie. He had reached the great age of 28, but in spite of his years and his dignity, he could still roll over. Not just halfway, but a complete once-over. It was tremendous to behold. And when his rheumatism didn't bother him, he kicked and capered like any frisky colt. Mr. Spinks was a tough yet tender man. He thought a lot of Charlie, who had been a strong puller in his day. So he retired him and gave him a field all to himself with a nice rain barrel for drinking water. Of course, it was a small field, and nothing much would grow on it anyway, nothing but nasty thistles and chickweed. Charlie despised them both. One was too prickly, the other too bitter. Quite regularly, Mr. Spinks managed to bring him a wisp of hay, but even so, Charlie grew hungry and bored with life. He felt so useless. He missed the busyness of the old days, the plowing and planting, the logging and hauling, the raking and reaping. And he had nowhere at all to go, not to the mill house to grind the grain, not to the greengrocer's to deliver parsnips and peas and potatoes, nor to the blacksmith for a new set of shoes, not even to the old Boar's Head Inn on Cow Cross Road. Perhaps what happened at the Boar's Head was what he missed most of all. Charlie remembered how every afternoon at the stroke of 5, Bertie would appear. And she was not a bird at all. She was a plump-chested cook in a white apron. She would bounce out of the inn like a cuckoo from a clock. Then she would pull a stout rope beside the door, which set a bell to ringing. This meant that the apple tarts were nicely browned and ready to come out of the oven. Quick as flies, the people would come swarming. There were teamsters and tailors, carpenters and cobblers, bankers and barristers, goldsmiths, silversmiths, and blacksmiths. They came afoot, they came on wagons, they came in fine carriages. In the courtyard they separated. Some went indoors, and the others gathered at the swing-out, swing-in window in the kitchen. Mr. Spinks was one who went inside. He enjoyed a bumper of punch with his apple tart. Charlie was always left standing at the hitching rail with the lines wrapped loosely around it. He towered above the elegant little hackneys and the workaday cobs. The moment Mr. Spinks disappeared, Charlie used to pull the lines free and lumber over to the swing-in, swing-out window, and there he would wait politely while the two-legged creatures were served. They all slapped him affectionately on the rump as they went back to their carts and carriages. Then at last it would be Charlie's turn. His nostrils would flutter in excitement as Bertie held out the flat of her hand, and on it was always a beautiful apple tart, oozing with juices that smelled of sugar and spices. "Charlie, you rascal," she would exclaim. "Now you get back to the hitching rail and do your eating there. I don't want you slobbering all over my clean window." When Mr. Spinks finally came out, wiping his whiskers on his sleeve, he never seemed to notice that Charlie's lines were no longer wrapped about the rail. He just hooked him up, climbed onto the seat of the wagon, and gave a to Charlie, and off they went, would go, home to Tulip Hill. In his retirement, Charlie sadly missed this 5 o'clock treat. He felt hungry and forlorn in his silent field, with only the grasshoppers thrumming their wings together and a woodpecker drilling holes in an old dead tree. Morning, noon, and night were all alike. It was a world of nothing but weeds and sky. And day by day his head drooped lower and his tail hung limp as an old rope. A month dragged by. Then late one afternoon a curious thing happened. Charlie was aroused from his daydreaming by the wind. It was blowing sharply, bringing city smells and city sounds. He lifted his head, and suddenly the time clock in his mind began ringing. It was as if he heard a bell. He had to answer it. He trotted across the field, around the old dead tree, past the water barrel, faster and faster until he broke into a gallop. He was heading straight for the fence, and he was going to jump it. With all his strength and power, he collected his great bulk and flung himself up and over. But he was traveling too fast. His forefeet struck the top rail, smashing it to bits. He didn't even feel or hear the crash. He was over. He was free. In a burst, he was down the lane and out upon the pike, galumping toward the village. His feathers swished, and his hoofs clanked. Gallop, gallop, gallipity-gallop. Stately and bold and full of purpose, he trotted gaily around the bend, down through a gap in the hills, past the old steeple church, and into Cow Cross Road. It was just like the old days. There was the friendly Boar's Head Inn and the same jolly people gathering at the window. They seemed delighted to see him and thumped him more affectionately than ever. "Let's give first place to Charlie," one said, and they all bowed and made way for him. When he reached the swing-in window, he bunted it with his nose and came face to face with Bertie. "Eek!" She almost dropped the plate of apple tarts. "Charlie!" she cried. "Charlie! Charlie!" And she reached up and kissed him on the nose. Then she chose the biggest, brownest, juiciest tart of all for him, and she let him eat it right there at the window. It was better than old times. There was no waiting in line and no wagon to pull. Charlie hadn't been so happy in weeks. He trumpeted his joy to the people. Then, with a snort of greeting to the unfortunate horses tied at the rail, he galumped back home at an easy gait, the feathers on his feet swinging in a little breeze he made. He felt young and frisky again, and his loneliness vanished like a fog when the sun comes out. Each day now he trotted to the inn and arrived a jot before 5 o'clock, and each day he bunted the swing-in window and poked his nose into the kitchen. If the kettle was hissing and the dishes making a clatter, he let out a lusty bugle to make Bertie notice him. She always jumped and grabbed herself as if an icicle had dropped down her bosom. "Lor, love a duck," she exclaimed. "It must be time to ring the bell. Whatever would I do without you, Charlie?" And she bounced out of the inn like the cuckoo from the clock. And soon the bell was binging and bonging, and farmers' wagons were pulling up, and fine carriages were all about, and people were swarming into the inn for their apple tarts and tea. Slowly a beautiful thing was happening to Charlie. Bertie began depending more and more on him to remind her when it was tea time. He became her alarm clock. Then something even more wonderful happened. She taught him how to take the rope between his big yellow teeth and ring the bell himself. At last he had something important to do. Every day, rain or shine, summer or winter. Of course, Mr. Spinks heard about these daily jaunts. The news traveled to Tulip Hill and well beyond. And one afternoon, as he was sauntering in to the Boar's Head, he caught sight of Charlie, large as life, over at the window. He fancied for a moment the thought of speaking to Charlie, but he couldn't quite bring himself to do it. He just gave a wink in his direction. Then, chuckling, he quickly turned his head, pretending not to see. It was a kind of secret shared. In the course of time, Mr. Spink's wife noticed the broken fence rail. "Land sakes alive!" she exclaimed. "Will you look at what that no-good-for-nothing Charlie has done? Mind that you mend that fence at once," she scolded. In fact, she had to scold Mr. Spinks again and again, and each time he would scratch his head thoughtfully and then reply in the same way, "Quite right, my dear. Some day I'll fix it." But he never did. The end.
Charlie, 5 o'clock. Every day.
Well, you know, animals are really funny, and horses are as bad as anybody else. They get used to getting fed at a certain time, and if you aren't out there to feed them at that time, they get unhappy.
They really are creatures of habit. I remember when I changed my work schedule, and I was off on different days of the week, it really confused my dogs. And, you know, you never anticipate that. Well, you're joining Library on the Go on KSJD, Dryland Community Radio, 90.5 and 91.5 FM. And Miss Barbara's going to wrap it up with another story.
Yes, we have one more. This is called The Giant King, written by Kathleen T. Pelly, illustrated by Maury J. Manning, published by Child and Family Press. If I can turn the page, we'll get started. Long ago in Scotland, there once lived a carpenter's son called Rabbi. Every day, Rabbi worked alongside his father, learning how to make tables and chests and cradles that rocked as smooth and gentle as a summer's breeze. And often when the day's work was done, Rabbi would make his own carvings, swallows gliding with wings outstretched, a sheepdog, its face crumpled with sleep, or a baby snuggled in the crook of a mother's arms. And so lifelike were his carvings that some who saw them swore they could almost hear the rustle of wings or feel the cold, damp muzzle of a dog. "However do you make such fine figures from a block of old wood?" they'd ask. But Rabbi would only shrug. "They were in the wood all along," he'd say. "I only discovered what was hiding there." Sometimes people would ask Rabbi to make a special carving for a son's birthday or a daughter's wedding, and they'd bring along a favorite dog or a soft purring kitten. "Can you make a carving of this?" they'd ask. Rabbi would bend down and run his hands along the creature's back, stroking and patting and kneading. He'd press his face against the animal's mouth and breathe in, one long, deep breath after another. Finally, he would set to work, whittling and chiseling until the carving was finished. "It's grand, Rabbi," some would say, while others would gasp and cry, "But it's too grand to be our dog Nell. You can't see the gash on her leg or the lump on her ear. Why do you make things better than they really are?" But Rabbi would only smile. "You see with your eyes," he explained, "and so you see what it is. But I carve with my heart, and so I see what can be, what might be." "The lad's a bit of a dreamer," the carpenter would say with a sigh, and the people would nod and smile, but still they paid Rabbi well and hurried off home, clutching their carvings close like a promise. As the years passed, Rabbi traveled to other towns and villages, making carvings for wealthy merchants and important lords. Now it happened that one day, while he was staying in a far-off town where the king himself lived, Rabbi saw a great commotion there. Crowds of people scurried to and fro in a terrible froth of confusion as a mighty giant thundered through the marketplace. Roaring and bellowing, the giant capsized stalls, toppled tables, and smashed crates of fruit and barrels of grain. Some of the people huddled together, white-faced and trembling, while others ran after the giant, shaking their fists and cursing him. Some even picked up cabbages and hurled them at the giant's legs. "Get back to your cave, you beast," they shouted. With one blood-curdling roar, the giant heaved two crates of turnips on his shoulders and lumbered out of the marketplace, crashing down the path that led to the mountain called Ben Cullen. "Who is that man?" asked Robbie, turning to the group of townspeople at his side. "He's not a man," growled the innkeeper. "He's a brute, a monster, an animal." "His name is Duncan McKinnon," said the innkeeper's wife. "He came here nearly 1 year ago, wanting to make his home here in our town. Imagine a giant living with decent folk like us." "We ran him out of town," added one of the merchants, "but now he lives in a cave on Ben Cullen. Every day he comes down here to steal our food and frighten our wee bairns." "Aye, no one can rid us of this animal," said the innkeeper. "But surely he only behaves like an animal because you treat him like one," said Rabbi. "If you were to treat him like a king, then he would act like a king." An angry mutter rumbled through the crowd. "Treat him like a king? What foolishness!" they scoffed. But there were some who nodded and smiled at Rabbi's words. "He could be right," they said. And one of the king's counselors, who was in the crowd, hurried off to tell the king what he had heard. As the people argued back and forth, into the town rode the old king himself. "You will do as the lad says," he commanded. "Tomorrow you will treat this giant like a king. Sing to him, dance for him, and offer him gifts. Then bring him to me, and I will decide what is to become of him. Go now, and make ready for the royal giant." And so the people hurried off to obey their king, and Rabbi returned to his room at the inn. In the morning, Rabbi awoke to the sound of bells ringing from the steeples. Out in the street he saw flags flapping from the rooftops and ribbons streaming from the windows. "Here comes the giant," called a boy who was sitting in the branches of an oak tree. Rabbi watched the giant as he pounded up the hill with his red face twisted into a tight knot of anger. Roaring and bellowing, the giant thundered through the streets. But today the people stood in their doorways and bowed down as he passed them by. "Hail, gracious giant," they cried. Soon the giant's roars lowered to a muffled rumbling, and his heavy pounding slowed to a steady march. Clusters of children scampered into the treetops and showered him with blossoms. "Bless our gentle giant," they cried. "May his life be long and happy." Rabbi, who ran alongside the giant, saw his face crinkle now into a faint, shadowy smile. When they reached the town square, Rabbi bowed to the giant and said, "Rest now, gallant giant, rest and eat." So the giant sat beneath the shade of a sycamore tree while the townspeople brought him jugs of milk, trays of fruit and honey, and platters of plump roast chickens. Then they brought out their pipes and fiddles and flutes, and they began to sing and dance. All through the day, as sunbeams toppled through the leaves, Rabbi and the giant watched the people swirling and whirling in a great flurry of delight. "Do they really dance for me?" the giant asked, turning to Rabbi, and his voice was deep and low like the rumble of a waterfall. "Oh, yes," replied Rabbi, "it is all for you." And the giant's face crumpled into a wide, floppy smile. The afternoon shadows lengthened, the sun began to sink behind the jagged peaks of Ben Cullen, and in the purple glimmer of twilight, the children gathered around to sing their last song, a cradle song, soft and slow and sweet. Rabbi watched the giant's eyes flickering shut as he fell into a deep sleep. The cool breeze now ruffled the leaves, and a wee lass, seeing the giant begin to shiver, took off her coat and ran over to him. "Poor giant," she whispered. "See how cold he is." And she tried to cover him with her coat, but of course the coat was so tiny that it barely covered the giant's enormous hand. She called to her friends, and soon all the children, and their mothers and fathers as well, were peeling off their coats and shawls. Tying them together, they made an enormous patchwork quilt, which they flung across the giant, covering his chest and shoulders. "Sleep now, gentle giant," said the child, as she kissed his rough red cheek. "In the morning we will bring you our gifts." As the children turned to leave, Rabbi wiped away a tear that trickled down the giant's face. Then he pressed his cheek against the giant's mouth and breathed in one long, deep breath after another. Finally he stood up and hurried back to his room at the inn. All night, Rabbi worked on his gift for the giant. By the light of fire and candle, he carved and chiseled until his eyes stung, his fingers ached, and his heart throbbed. In the morning, he picked up his carving and hurried off to the town square. There sat the giant, surrounded by swarms of people, bringing their gifts of fruit and flowers and honey. "I, too, have a gift for you," Rabbi cried. The giant's eyes opened wide in wonder as he held Rabbi's carving. "This looks like me," he gasped. "And yet it cannot be, for this is a king sitting on a throne with a crown and a cape." Rabbi smiled. "But it is you," he said, "for I carve not what is, but what can be." Then clapping his hands, he shouted, "Quickly now, a crown for our king giant and a cape." At once, the children gathered armfuls of bluebells and wove them into a circle. Then, scrambling into the treetop, they placed the purple crown on the giant's head. The women scooped up the patchwork quilt of coats and shawls, and they too clambered up the tree and draped it over the giant's shoulders. Laughing and shouting, all the people followed the giant as Rabbi led the procession to the king's castle. But at the gates of the castle, Rabbi stopped in alarm, for there stood the king with his whole army behind him, their sharp swords glinting in the sun. "Halt!" shouted the king. "How dare my own people treat this animal as if he were a king? I will punish them for their treachery." And he raised his arm as if to give the command to attack. But the giant flung himself before the king. "No," he bellowed. "You will have to slay me first before you lay a hand on these people. They are my friends, and they have loved me well." At once the king cast down his sword and laid his hands on the giant's shoulder. "Arise now, noble giant," he said. "Indeed, you have proved that you can act like a king, for only a king would lay down his life for his people. Now you must come and live here in our kingdom." And so it was that the giant came to live in the king's own castle, and after some years, when the old king died, the people made the giant their king. Rabbi returned to his father's shop, where he continued to carve the finest figures in all the land, and now and then a passing traveler would stop and ask him, "Aren't you the lad who made that giant into a king?" But Rabbi would only smile. "Oh, no," he'd tell the stranger. "He was always a king. I only discovered what was hiding there in his heart all along." The end.
If only more of us could be more like Rabbi.
Yes, and, you know, it's interesting that my husband does some wood carving, and I've known several other people that do it, and they all say the same thing. You look at a piece of wood to see what's in it before you start carving it.
Yeah, and it may not be what other people think it should be, but the carver knows.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. We have story times every Thursday at 10:30. We're about a month away from starting our summer reading program, and also in June we'll start our Farmers Market story times. We also air here every Sunday at 3:30 in the afternoon on KSJD Dryland Community Radio, 91.5 and 90.5 FM. And we also can be reached if you want to go ahead and stream that live. You can go to ksjd.org, and right in the upper left-hand corner is a button for listen. And we're also archiving some of our shows, so we're excited about that. We'll let you know when those get on the website as well. Let me tell you a little bit about what we do here at the studio. We come every Wednesday afternoon, and we tape usually two shows, and so that's an hour for 2 half-hour shows. And sometimes we have to start over because we make boo-boos. And sometimes we don't start over, even if we do make boo-boos. And Miss Barbara practices at home, and she times the stories out, so she makes sure that she stays to about 25 minutes on reading the stories. And then I do a little bit of the commentary, and I also run the board. And running the board involves turning everything on, getting ready to record the show, and then making sure the volume is just right. We also have something that, what did Tom call it, a volumizer, that kind of evens everything out as well. But we do still have to be careful that it's not too high, it's not too low. And then we also had Tom, the station manager, record some songs. We'll have some more recorded. And we just kind of picked some favorite children's songs, and we hope that you've been enjoying those. In fact, right now I'm going to be playing Camptown Races again, and we hope you enjoyed this show. And I don't know if Miss Barbara had anything to say.
I just want to remind you that the library is open for everybody with lots and lots and lots of stories, and we're barely scratching the surface, so come in and see what we've got.
And we're discovering new stories as we go.
Yes, we are.
Okay, here we go, Camptown Races.
Camptown ladies sing this song. Doo-da, doo-da. Camptown racetrack's 5 miles long. Oh, it's a doo-da day. Gonna run all night. Gonna run all day. Bet my money on a bobtail nag. Somebody bet on the bay.
Thank you for joining us.